Cosmos greetings and welcome to Prolet Cult, the Antifada side project on the paranormal, parapolitical, conspiracy theories, sci-fi, and space. We have a jam-packed show today on the subject of Space Force. Is it some Trumpian flight of fancy or a doomsday plan for astronuclear American hegemony? I talked to Bruce K. Gagnon, a lifelong activist against the militarization of space, for his perspective. But before that, my own, in the form of an audio essay I call The Plot Against Space. Some listeners contacted me for a transcript of my last audio essay on Star Wars from Prolet Cult 6, so Pluto Press was kind enough to publish this text on their blog. And while you're there, please,
buy my book! Buy my book! Buy my book!
I Want to Believe, Jay Posadas, UFOs, and Apocalypse Communism is available from PlutoBooks.com with a 20% discount using code Posadas20. If, for some reason, you're on the space fence about buying my book, listen to the end of the episode for a delightful reading of part of the introduction by the honey-voiced Brett O'Shea of Rev Left Radio.
The Mercury Project, the Apollo missions, and the Mars Probe. Now NASA embarks on its most daring and exciting project yet.
Last Friday, Donald Trump unveiled the Space Force's new flag at an Oval Office ceremony, hinting that its troopers might wield a super-duper missile that can travel 17 times faster than any other. Many saw the spectacle, alongside his recent executive order to mine the moon and musings of developing a nuclear-powered spaceship that could travel direct to Mars, as promises deranged and empty as his coast-to-coast border wall, purchase of Greenland, or threat of nuking hurricanes. Even his 2018 announcement of the Space Force was mocked with memes of a face-palming Picard, or gifs of Bob Odenkirk and David Cross from the 1997 Mr. Show sketch in which NASA announces, for no apparent reason, that it will blow up the moon.
Thank you very much. We have an announcement to make. On July 4th of this year, America will blow up the moon.
We have the technology. The time is now. Science can wait no longer. Children are our future. America can, should, must, and will blow up the moon.
Yes, and we'll be doing it during a full moon, so we make sure we get it all.
And yet, just 18 months after the laughter died down, the United States Space Force officially emerged as the sixth branch of the U.S. military. At a tenth the size of the Marine Corps, with 16,000 personnel, it is by far the smallest, but is already aggressively recruiting for its planned annual expansion.
Some people look to the stars and ask, what if? Our job is to have an answer. Maybe you weren't put here just to ask the questions. Maybe you were put here to be the answer. Maybe your purpose on this planet isn't on this planet.
NASA followed Trump's lead Friday by announcing an Artemis plan of dividing celestial bodies in Earth's orbit into spheres of national and private influence. So the future, they say, can look more like Star Trek and a lot less like Star Wars. The name of this plan refers to NASA's Artemis program, of establishing a lunar colony and traveling to Mars over the next two decades, and invokes the 1968 Outer Space Treaty as a guiding influence. But without acknowledging the USSF's active militarization and new space age corporate speculation are part and parcel to the plan, NASA has become a public relations front for a continued campaign of cosmic imperialism in direct conflict with the spirit of that treaty, which sought to defend against militarization of space by designating it collective and international. In an interview with GEN, USSF Commander David Thompson described their little-discussed actual operations. Far from sci-fi images of armed shuttles patrolling orbit, he says they are, for now, only taking on the tasks previously under the purview of the U.S. Air Force's Space Command. such as keeping track of a growing number of orbital objects, developing new space technologies, and maintaining GPS and other communication capabilities primarily for military, but also civilian use. Now a distinct military branch, he says, they will do these while developing their own distinct culture. Although largely superficial, that final task has received the most attention. At the White House ceremony, the Space Force flag was unfurled to reveal a logo invoking both NASA and Star Trek in an effort to steal some golden era space age shine. SpaceX CEO and USSF partner Elon Musk said as much in a March conversation with David Thompson. Quote, "We've got to make Starfleet happen. When the public hears the Space Force, that's what they think. It's like, okay, we're going to have some sweet spaceships and pretty good uniforms and stuff," end quote. Aside from design sensibility, Space Force or SpaceX resemble the Defense Force of the United Federation of Planets very little. Their mission is not to maintain peace and freedom within our Federation borders, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, and to boldly go where no one has gone before, but to strengthen U.S. empire and create immense profits for corporations like Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Blue Origin, and Halliburton, to name a few. In order to do so, they must first roll back the half-century of treaties designating space as the collective frontier of mankind. Congress passed legislation encouraging moon and asteroid mining in 2015, and in 2017, the Department of Defense announced it would treat space as a war-fighting domain by using satellites to coordinate use of force on the ground. This February, space policy consultant Rand Simberg wrote a column for Reason, equating the collective concept of space as socialism. He argued that space should be instead treated like the American frontier. The Trump administration concurred this year in its executive order, quote, "Outer space is a legally and physically unique domain of human activity, and the United States does not view it as a global commons. Accordingly, it shall be the policy of the United States to encourage international support for the public and private recovery and use of resources in outer space. The imminent goal, however, is controlling life on Earth. Space Force will protect the rollout of satellite arrays for the purpose of spying and implementation of 5G networks. There are, of course, civilian uses for these technologies, but their main purpose is reinforcing communication between military installations, coordinating airstrikes, protecting friendly satellite networks while threatening hostile ones, coordinating an anti-missile space fence designed to protect the United States from retaliation should it launch a nuclear first strike. Some of these capabilities have already been showcased in January skirmishes with Iran. The hostile undertones of space exploration are nothing new. For the Soviet state, the launch of the first artificial satellite Sputnik in 1957 was less about scientific progress than showing off the increased range of their intercontinental ballistic missiles. The subsequent space race began with an even more hostile plan from the U.S. government. A group of scientists were instructed to draw up plans to detonate a nuclear weapon on the moon by 1959 in an act of intimidation. The plan was scrapped after researchers, including then-graduate student Carl Sagan, determined a failed launch could nuke the Earth. Perhaps blowing up the moon was not such an absurd sketch after all. To be fair, that satire was less about history than the present. In the sketch, the public greets the announcement that the moon will be destroyed with the same sort of jingoistic flag-waving that accompanied military interventions against Iraq. The enthusiasm is only interrupted when one of the monkeys trained to carry out the mission asks in sign language, why?
We're ahead of schedule, way ahead of schedule, but we're having fun. Ken here is talking to Galileo, the monkey knows sign language. And when we... What? What's funny?
Galileo just asked why. He said, why are you blowing up the moon?
Yeah.
Controversy and America reacts.
Monkey sure took the fun out of everything.
Yeah, we had this whole party planned.
Well, there isn't going to be any party now.
Hey, Mr. Monkey, don't be asking why. Don't you know you can't mess with American pride?
With all the mockery of Trump, too few are asking this simple question today. This may be because, aside from Trump's buffoonish distractions, space exploration is simply too exciting, too intangible, too seemingly harmless to raise widespread concern. How can one oppose corporations mining the moon or asteroids without at least equal concern spent to the exploitative and environmentally destructive continuation of terrestrial extractivism? How can we oppose increasingly sophisticated arrays of spy satellites when there is no opposition to the apparently irreversible strengthening of the Patriot Act? Why would we worry about the space fence when Trump's DHS camps are at capacity with sick and dying migrants and refugees, and construction on his border wall already destroys miles of sacred borderlands? Historian of space colonialism Harris Durrani wrote for The Nation earlier this year about how some have fought back. In 1979, realizing the insufficiencies of the Outer Space Treaty, 18 states have ratified a Moon Treaty that seeks to strengthen the idea of a Pacific and collective space through the creation of a legal framework enforced by an international regime. In 1976, several developing and non-aligned nations met in Colombia to announce a more radical declaration of independence of space as a, quote, universal community. As leverage, they called on participating countries to withhold their tropical real estate, the most valuable both for launching pads and orbital positions, to any first-world space programs who would not comply. Although these efforts failed, the people of these countries have occasionally taken matters into their own hands. In 2017, protesters occupied the world's second busiest spaceport in French Guiana against poverty in the country attributed to the neglect of their French colonial rulers. A similar disruption is ongoing since last year in the Big Island of Hawaii against a telescopic facility planned for the summit of Mauna Kea. Durrani hopes stories like these could inspire actions against Space Force installations in the Marshall Islands and other U.S. territories, or the Alcantara Launch Center in Brazil that Bolsonaro signed away to Trump last year. Likewise, the organization Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space has continued to investigate space militarization and privatization and organize regular direct actions against it since the 80s. The space age has always served as both a promise, a threat, and a way of distracting and overwhelming the realities of space. This, too, is illustrated succinctly by Mr. Show, when the sketch transitions seamlessly to the next, beginning with an office worker seeing the moon explode in the night sky out his office window. "They did it. They blew up the moon," he informs his unimpressed boss, who promptly shuts the blinds and tells him to get back to work.
"Hey, they did it, sir."
"What?"
"They blew up the moon."
"Is that an idea?"
Stay tuned. In just a moment, I'll be talking to Bruce K. Gagnon from the Global Network.
Okay, Bruce, Mr. Gagnon, thank you for joining us. You are part of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. So just tell our listeners a little bit about how that group started and what it is you do.
Okay. It began in 1992. Myself, New York journalism professor Carl Grossman from Long Island, and a group in Colorado Springs called Citizens for Peace in Space. We were really the only people at that time in the country that were consistently working on trying to prevent an arms race from moving into space, the nuclearization and the weaponization of space. And we saw that our local work in Florida, where I was living at the time, working for the Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice, it was one of our main issues that we worked on. And our friends in Colorado and Carl Grossman doing a lot of writing around these issues as a journalist, we said, you know, we've got to take this out in around the country and internationally more. So we created the Global Network then in 1992. We realized that the U.S. had set up bases all over the world. Downlink stations are called, radar receiving stations that talk to the satellites as they orbit the Earth. They send their signal below. And in many of these communities, in Australia, in England, in northern up in Norway, right on the Russian border, and many other places around the world, Japan, Korea, the U.S. had set up these bases, and people in those communities didn't like it. They didn't want their country to be used as a place to help make Star Wars possible. And so we started traveling to these places and getting to know people, and they became essentially the membership of the global network. In fact, just yesterday, we held a board meeting online. We had 20 people from about 10 different countries, and it was, you know, work that we have been doing for a long time. We've put together quite a great team of folks around the world. Usually we have an annual meeting in a different country that's a part of this whole U.S. Star Wars program. But this year we were going to meet in Canada, but we had to cancel because of the virus. And so we had a little meeting online yesterday, and we'll continue to do that. So that's really how we got started, and I've been coordinating the global network since it was created.
Thanks. And it seems like most of your work, correct me if I'm wrong, is raising awareness of the further militarization of space.
Well, you know, we've always been about understanding that we could lobby like hell all day in Washington to try to stop this, but we don't have a base. We don't have a constituency. And so our first goal was to create an international constituency, and that meant we have to get out around the world and educate people about what is planned, that the U.S. wants to control and dominate space and deny other countries access to space. And now we see today the Space Force has just been created. So people can't really, and Noam Chomsky has long said, people can't really react to things they don't know anything about. So that's always been our number one job. But we use many different tools, including direct action, to try to get people to know about things. Every time we have a conference in a different country, it's always, we always have a protest that goes along with it at that particular, usually a U.S. military installation that's part of the Star Wars program. And then every year in the fall, during October, we have a week of actions around the world called Keep Space for Peace Week, where we ask people to hold local events. And, you know, throughout that week of activity. So, and in between many of these different places, they have regular protests, daily protests, weekly protests at these installations where they live in various countries. So there's always a lot of things happening, and we try to make videos, and we put out, we publish a newspaper called Space Alert. So we have many different ways of trying to essentially build this global consciousness that is required if we're ever going to be able to stop any of this madness.
And we'll certainly link to that in the show notes, so our listeners can check that out. But I want to get a more concrete understanding of what this means to militarize space and what the conception of space was before and what it's turning into now. So the 1967 Outer Space Treaty and the Moon Agreement were kind of the two keystone international law accords about how space was to be perceived as international and collective. Today there's seems to be conscious pushback on that conception. So maybe you could just walk us through what that means, what it meant that space was once seen as international collective, and what the United States is doing today.
Yeah, during the 1960s, as the nuclear arms race was really growing, the U.S. was, along with Russia and other countries, it was in everyone's interest to make sure that weapons of mass destruction, and those are the key words, were not permanently stationed in space. That was the fear. The U.S. Army had long been developing a plan for military bases on the moon, controlling the moon, and other such things. So the Outer Space Treaty banned weapons of mass destruction in space, and also said that all the planetary bodies were the province of all humankind, that no country, no corporation, no individual can claim ownership of the planetary bodies. And then the moon, and so many countries, including the U.S., signed that treaty, the Outer Space Treaty. The Moon Treaty became a little more specific and banned all military operations on the moon and said nobody can, again, take ownership or land claims of the moon. The U.S. refused to sign that treaty, and that then led other countries not to sign it as well. But some countries did, at the U.N., did sign the Moon Treaty. But in recent years, the technologies have expanded so that the Pentagon now says that, well, the Outer Space Treaty, it only covers weapons of mass destruction, and we're working on weapons of selective destruction in space that fall outside the treaty. So therefore, we can do other things in space, you know, other military applications, as they call it, in space. They can deploy them.
So your organization's name, again, is the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power, and some might find the nuclear aspect outdated because we don't talk a lot about the threat of nuclear war anymore. But recently, Trump suggested using nuclear-powered spacecraft for a mission to Mars and other space missions. So how serious do you think that proposal is, and what are its risks?
Well, the use of the words nuclear power in our name was never really much about nuclear weapons. It was more about using nuclear technology to colonize space. Nuclear rockets powered with nuclear reactors, nuclear powered mining colonies on the moon and Mars and planetary bodies, and nuclear generators on missions to deep space. Today, the little rover driving around Mars is powered with a nuclear device. In 1989, the NASA launched Galileo mission carrying on board nuclear generator. We opposed that, went into federal court. It was a huge, huge issue. It became an international issue. In 1990, they launched Ulysses, another one with nuclear, the generator on board. Again, we went into federal court. And then in 1997, they launched Cassini mission to deep space with 72 pounds of plutonium on board. And in that particular case, it became a major international issue. And we learned from people inside the White House that they received more communications opposing that launch than in any other issue in the history of the United States. So we were very successful in creating a lot of global debate during those years around nuclear devices. And in fact, right before the launch of Cassini in 1997, a article came out in the New Mexican, the newspaper from Santa Fe, New Mexico, reporting on the laboratory in nearby community, Department of Energy laboratory, where they were fabricating the generator for the Cassini mission. And the article said that while the workers were constructing this generator, there were 244 cases of worker contamination. And so the issue has always been the Department of Energy laboratories have a terrible history of radioactive releases into the air, into local water systems, worker contaminations. And so we've always said that not only the launching is dangerous, but the whole fabrication process is very dangerous. But then in the environmental impact statement for the Cassini mission, NASA admitted that if there was a launch pad accident and a release of the plutonium into the air, the winds would carry it for a 60-mile radius. That means from the Space Center at Cape Canaveral all the way to Disney World in Orlando, north to Daytona Beach and south to Vero Beach, Florida, a 60-mile radius. The people would have to be removed. The buildings would have to be removed. The vegetation would have to be removed. The animals, the fish, the birds, the alligators, the squirrels, everything would have to be removed. Can you imagine that? And then on top of all that, they would have to take away the top half inch of soil that would be radioactive for thousands of years. So you'd have a nuclear wasteland. Now, in today's world, we can't even deal with this virus pandemic in a proper way. And how could we imagine that a 60-mile radioactive mess in the middle of Florida, Central Florida, could be dealt with? So these nuclear launches are a real danger to the planet. And in fact, there have been accidents over the years. And in fact, both the United States and the former Soviet Union had plutonium and uranium releases when some of their space missions carrying these devices fell back to Earth, burned up on reentry, and scattered the debris. One of them, back in 1996, the Russian mission to Mars burned up on reentry as it didn't achieve orbit properly and released its deadly materials over the mountains in Bolivia and Peru and that whole region. In 1964, a U.S. military satellite carrying 2 pounds of plutonium burned up on reentry, spread the plutonium globally as dust, and scientists that studied it believes it's one of the major contributors to cancers on the Earth today. So nuclear power and the industry viewing space as a new market is what we've always been talking about. I want to say something else, getting back to the two treaties, the Outer Space Treaty and the Moon Treaty, recognizing that they're out of date, recognizing that they need to be reinforced, considering the new technologies that exist today. Russia and China, for more than 25 years, have been annually going to the United Nations General Assembly and introducing a resolution calling for a new treaty called Prevention of an Arms Race in Outer Space, PAROS, PAROS. And every year it overwhelmingly passes at the General Assembly as a resolution, and it is then directed to the UN Permanent Conference on Disarmament in Geneva for negotiation. And it is there that US and Israel have been blocking this treaty during both Republican and Democrat administrations for the last 25 years. The official position of the US is, hey, there's no problem. There are no weapons in space. We don't need a new treaty. And the reason for this, of course, is that the aerospace industry in the United States, one of the major sectors that controls our government today, doesn't want a restriction on the ability to develop a new arms race in space, because they've long said in their industry publications that Star Wars would be the largest industrial project in the history of the planet. In other words, they would make so much money, more money than ever made on anything before. And in fact, in one of their publications called Space News some years ago, they said, you know, we've got to come up with a dedicated funding source to pay for this. And we have. And we're now sending our lobbyists to Washington to secure it. And they called it the entitlement programs that officially are Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, and what's left of the social safety net. So these are the programs that the aerospace industry, the military industrial complex, have identified for defunding in order to pay for what I call pyramids to the heavens.
That's incredible. I think a lot of people still have a lot of optimism about space travel and research and even exploitation of the moon or passing asteroids, because they feel like it would be something that would benefit all mankind, that we would learn things, learn about ourselves, enrich ourselves. It's pretty clear from at least this new space age, if not, if it was any different than the previous space age, that this is, it's not going to change anything on Earth. So another initiative by the Trump administration has been talking about mining the moon. What does this idea look like?
Well, first, let me say that we're at a point today where they've begun to privatize more and more of NASA's space operations. And the reason why they've done that is because you, the taxpayers, for many years, since after World War II, when the Nazi rocket scientists Wernher von Braun, Major General Walter Dornberger, who was Hitler's head of the V1 and V2 program, rocket program that Hitler used to terrorize the cities of London and Paris and Brussels and other cities during the end of World War II in a desperate attempt to hold out and win the war. After the war, they brought, in a program called Operation Paperclip, a secret program, they brought 1,500 of the top Nazi scientists and militarists to the United States, and 100 of them were von Braun, the scientist, rocket scientist, and his rocket team, and along with 100 copies of the V-2 rocket. They brought them to Huntsville, Alabama, to create the U.S. space program. Major General Walter Dornberger, who was, again, Hitler's liaison between the government and the rocket team, the rocket scientists, came to the United States and went to work for Bell Aerospace, became a vice president. In the 1950s, he testified before the United States Congress saying, "Gentlemen, I didn't come to this country to lose the third world war. We lost two already. We need to control the moon, and we need to control the Earth-Moon gravity well by putting militarized space stations on either side of the moon." And so basically the idea is the Earth-Moon gravity well is like a wishing well. Imagine someone is down at the bottom of a wishing well and you're at the top. Because of gravity, you control who can get, you know, in and out of the well. And it's the same way getting off the Earth. If you control the Earth-Moon gravity well at the L4 and L5 positions on either side of the moon, you can literally control who gets on and off the planet. And so in a congressional study in 1989 called Military Space Forces, the Next 50 Years, signed by many congressional leaders, including former Ohio Senator John Glenn, who was one of the first people to go into space. Bill Nelson, former senator from Florida, once went up on the space shuttle. Anyway, a host of these politicians signed off on this congressional study, and in it they said that with our armed forces lying in wait at that location, we would be able to hijack rival shipments upon return. So if anyone else tried to go out and mine the sky and they were not authorized, we could take them out. It's piracy. It's, you know, intergalactic piracy. And so this is what they've been working on. So now the day has come where the taxpayers, you, have paid all the years of research and development since the end of World War II. And so they're at the point now where they can literally begin to develop the technologies to go and mine the sky. They're now privatizing. And so guys like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk have created these big corporations to go out and do these tasks. So what do we know about Bezos? Well, look at the way he treats his workers at Amazon. He doesn't give a shit about the American people or anybody else on this planet. All he wants to do is make money. And so you can imagine that if these guys get a hold of the moon or various asteroids with gold on them and other planetary bodies, they're going to use the U.S. military. And this is, I think, one of the reasons why the Space Force has been announced at the same time that they announced this plan to colonize the moon and other places and to privatize it all. There's a relationship between these various activities that are happening. And there's a reason why the United States, why Trump has renounced the Moon Treaty, the Outer Space Treaty, won't discuss the prevention of an arms race in outer space. All these things are linked together. They're part of a bigger strategy that's been underway for a long, long time.
My reading of Space Force and this new space age of being spearheaded by Bezos and Musk, among others, is that it's not purely about entrepreneurship and profit extraction and science. It's also about terrestrial geopolitics. So I guess that's a good segue to ask, you know, what exactly do you think Space Force is, and what is the end game of the Trump administration of the U.S. empire using space?
Well, I think your reading is sound. And I think that we know from, can you see me? Are you?
Yeah, I can see you.
Okay, I want to show you something.
Okay.
You might have already heard about or seen this Space Command document called Vision for 2020, created in the late 1997. It was created, U.S. Space Command, headquartered in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Here you see a satellite hitting targets on the Earth below. Space, the warfighter's edge. You see the Earth on this little pedestal here, controlled by space technology. So everything the military does today on the planet is coordinated, directed by space technology. They can see everything, they can intercept all communications, and they can target every place on the planet. When Bush, George W. Bush, launched Shock and Awe in Iraq in 2003, in the initial attack, 70% of the weapons that were used were directed to their targets by space technology. So in this vision for 2020, they lay out what they call control of space. Control of space is the ability to assure access to space, freedom of operations within the space medium, and an ability to deny others the use of space. So I think what the Space Force, it primarily has two jobs. Number one is to give corporate capitalism total control of planet Earth. They could see everything, they could hear everything, and they can target everything. The other job is to control the pathway on and off the planet for resource extraction in the years ahead. The Halliburton Corporation that was heavily involved in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars has been for years working on a drilling mechanism for mining Mars. We're told that the rovers are driving around Mars looking for the origins of life. Well, in fact, they're mapping the surface of Mars. They're doing soil identification, soil sampling, preparing for the day when they can have mining. And you, again, the taxpayer, paying for all these years of these Mars missions, the soil sampling, the mapping and everything else. And when the day comes, they can go out and successfully mine. It's going to be privatized. There was a bill introduced in Congress a few years ago. Thankfully, it didn't pass, but I'm sure it'll come around again at some point to give companies that go out and mine the sky make all of their profits tax-free. Can you imagine that? It's ridiculous. So the Space Force's job then is to control the Earth and to control the on and off journey to go out and mine the sky in the years ahead.
But some of the explainers that I've seen of Space Force, from some of its new commanders, is that most of what it does is it protects and coordinates U.S. spy satellite networks and makes sure that all the communications that are done to benefit the United States with satellites are in check and protected from hacks or, rival satellite networks or something like that. But they tend to be kind of vague about what exactly this means. They just sort of try to assuage people's fears that it's going to be like literally soldiers in space, at least not right away. So taking them at their word, what exactly are these satellites? What do they do? How much can they see? Is there any relation to Bezos and Musk's satellite array internet projects and also 5G or Trump's proposed space fence?
Yeah, it's all tied together. I was up in Sweden a few years back. Part of our Global Network annual meeting was held in northern Sweden. Come to find out, there's a big, huge space technology testing base up in that region that the U.S. largely controls. And we went to a downlink station where they're talking to the satellites, receiving images from satellites that orbit the Earth over that part of the world. And we got a tour, and they were explaining to us that a lot of the images that they get, they said, this is not military. This is all civilian. Everything we do is, we talk to civilian satellites and everything else. But after questioning them, they were honest enough to admit that the images they get from these so-called civilian satellites are then sold to the U.S. military. And so what we've learned over many years is that everything in space is dual use, meaning they might say it's civilian, you know, like GPS. Oh, they talk about GPS. Look, you can use it in your car. It's mapping. It's wonderful. But it's primarily a military technology. They don't talk much about that, though. So everything they do in space today is about military. And yes, it has civilian applications on the side. That's nice, great. But it's all about military. So military, again, directs everything. They're mapping everything. They're listening to everything. The space fence is essentially going to be this massive surveillance thing all over the, so they can see everything happening on the planet. They can see all the interactions. They can see all the military maneuvers by any country. And the U.S. also is heavily wedded to a first strike strategy. Space fence becomes very crucial, as all military space technology becomes very crucial in the development of first strike technology. Russia and China have renounced first strike. They say, we will never do a first strike. We will only use our nuclear forces as a retaliatory response if the United States attacks us. U.S. refuses to say that. It used to be an ABM treaty, anti-ballistic missile treaty, but the U.S. pulled out of it in 2002. And since that time, U.S. has been deploying so-called missile defense systems encircling Russia and China, putting them on the ocean, on Navy destroyers, Aegis destroyers, putting them on ground-based launchers of various types, encircling both Russia and China. Now, what is the job of missile defense? It's really misnamed, of course. It's about offense. Missile defense is the shield that would be used after a U.S. first strike attack. Some years ago, I read an account in Aviation Week and Space Technology magazine of a annual computer war game at the Space Command called the Red Team versus the Blue Team. And in that, they launched a first strike attack on Russia and China. And the first weapon they used was called the military space plane that flew down from orbit and dropped an initial attack. And then after that, the United States fired nuclear weapons trying to take out all the underground silos of Russia and China. They did everything they could to take out the submarines, both those countries, the nuclear submarines. So a full-bore nuclear attack. And then inevitably, though, they didn't get everything. And so Russia and China, after that initial attack, would try to launch their remaining retaliatory capability. And it is then that this so-called missile defense shield was used to try to pick off the remaining retaliatory capability, giving the U.S. a quote-unquote successful first strike attack. So this is what this whole damn system is all about, is giving the U.S. the capability to fight and win a nuclear war and to think that it could get away with limited losses on our side of the ocean as, you know, afterwards. And so these are the technologies that are being developed. So space fence, for example, becomes a crucial aspect, a crucial tool to be able to see everything again, see everything what's out there, and see everything as Russia and China launch their retaliatory capability. They use lots of nice words to downplay what this is all about, but in the end, this is what's happening. The other thing is the U.S., I just read an article the other day saying the X-37, the military space plane, looks like a mini space shuttle, is going up again. It's shown that it can stay. It's a drone, essentially. Can stay in orbit for 700 and some days at a time. And its job is to do surveillance. It's very likely its job is also to do anti-satellite, go up and find a way to injure or destroy or disable a Russian or Chinese military satellite that gives them a chance to see what's happening on the earth below. And then also, it could fly down when it comes back. It could fly down and drop an attack like it did in that computer war game that that the Space Command annually runs. So this is the bigger picture of what's happening today with all of this U.S. military space technology.
This is a quick technical question. I've just got two more for you. You mentioned these war games that are still ongoing even during the pandemic and the attempts to create the ability to launch a nuclear first strike. Do you, what do you think the rationale behind that is, knowing everything we know about nuclear winter and the idea that a nuclear war would basically end all life on the planet, at least human life? Is this pure madness or is there some real strategy there?
Well, there's a strategy, but it's a mad strategy, I remember years ago reading a book called Lame Deer, Seeker of Visions about a Lakota medicine man. And he was telling the story about when he went to the white man's school. They sent him to these schools where they train him to forget about being an Indian and try to get him to become a white man. And they talked about the Great White Father, and he saw a picture. He always imagined that the Great White Father was there was a picture of a monkey, I guess, in his classroom, and he thought that's what the Great White Father is. But anyway, he had a great sense of humor, this guy. But he talked about when the white man came to this continent, the native people quickly learned that the white man was blinded by his love for the green frog skin, the dollar bill. He couldn't see beyond it. He couldn't see his relationship to the earth, to the Mother Earth. He couldn't see his relationship to the water we drink, you know. And so as a result of his greed and his ego and his quest for power, his spiritual connection to the earth was broken. It was snapped. And I believe this very clear understanding that the native people had about the white culture is really the answer to your question. It's a spiritual disconnection to our Mother Earth, that today her body is in toxic shock. She's thrashing about. That's why we're having snow here in May in Maine, which is highly unusual. And this is the problem. These guys know about nuclear winter. They know about if you use missile defense to intercept an oncoming missile and you blow it up, they know that the nuclear device on board, when it blows up, it will release radiation down, you know, into the atmosphere. They know that. I one time saw on C-SPAN, a news conference where they were announcing a missile defense system. This was some years ago, probably 10 or 15 years ago. And a reporter asked this question: what happens if you successfully intercept this missile, especially, you know, in its descent phase as it's coming back to the Earth in the atmosphere? You blow it up because their missile defense systems are, they've got them for launch, mid-course, and then descent. So they try to hit them in all these different phases. So anyway, then the answer from this general was, if we hit it over the offending country, then it's their bad luck. Well, to this guy, the law of physics doesn't exist, right? The winds blow, it carries the pollution, the radioactive pollution, debris all over the planet. They don't want to know this stuff because they're blinded. They can't see it because they're blinded by power and greed. They want to be in charge of the planet. And they've swallowed this idea that America is the exceptional nation, the city on a hill, the great white city light, the great light. You know, it's a religious fanaticism. And we know now that the majority of U.S. military officers are Christian fundamentalists. And there's a direct link between Christian fundamentalism and this whole space program. In Colorado Springs, where the Space Command is headquartered, the U.S. Air Force Academy is headquartered, where they're training the new generation of officers, excuse me, for the Space Force. They've got some of the biggest Christian fundamentalist operations based in Colorado Springs. And they work overtime to make sure that they are controlling the ideological development of the people that work inside of this whole space program. So it's a really sick, sick, mad, insane, crazy program. Imbued with the grace of God.
So I think when people first heard about Space Force, a lot of people thought, well, this is Trump being crazy, doing his wacky thing, trying to win elections or whatever. And they just wrote it off as just, you know, one strange guy's madness. And from everything that you've told us, and it's been very fascinating, it may be the case that it's one individual man's madness, but it reflects the madness of what's been going on the entire space age and for much longer as well. But I want to ask what your thoughts are about space exploration in general. Are there any positive aspects to it? Do you think it's even a good thing overall that we've been to the moon and have explored Mars and have an international space station?
Well, I'm not opposed to space exploration. I loved the Star Trek series on TV years ago. But I remember they had what they called a prime directive. They talked about it in virtually every show. And it was do no harm. As you go out, you know, and you come in contact with other planetary bodies, do no harm. And that was an ethic that I really believe in. Today, I think we could say with confidence that the ethic behind the Space Force and Space Command and the corporations pushing everything is what I call a bad seed of greed, warfare, and environmental degradation and madness that has been planted into the depths of the soil and of the consciousness of the this earth. And now they're poised to carry this bad seed into the heavens, which I think is a colossal failure and a violation of do no harm. So I've always said that, you know what, let's slow this freight train down. Let's slow down, give the people of the world who are paying for this, okay, India is now developing a space program. They're working on anti-satellite weapons. We have two people on our board from India. Last October, I went there during Keep Space for Peace Week. One of our board members is a law professor. She organized this incredible space law conference at her college, at her law school. And 200 students came from all over the country, 20 different law schools. And they each did a presentation on various aspects of space law. It was mind-blowing. But they also have 300 million people living in poverty, basically the entire population of the United States living in poverty in India. So let's talk about priorities here. And yesterday on our call, this board member said, yes, explore, but don't exploit. That's one of her common constant refrains that she uses. So I think, you know, this is where we're at.
Bruce K. Gagnon, thank you so much for your time. It was really amazing talking to you. I'll put everything that you mentioned in the show notes, but what do you recommend our listeners check out for now if they're interested in getting involved, maybe participating in some of the direct actions you mentioned?
Well, first thing, I strongly urge everybody to watch what I think is the best documentary ever made on this subject by a French-Canadian filmmaker by the name of Denis Delestraque. It's called Pax, P-A-X, Pax Americana and the Weaponization of Space. It's out there on YouTube. You can watch the entire film for free. It covers virtually all of these issues that we've talked about here today. So I think it's a really, really fine, fine production. And anybody watches that, they're going to learn a hell of a lot and come away with a really deep understanding. We also, the Global Network, made a film back in 2003 called Arsenal of Hypocrisy that I narrate, and I would urge people to watch that as well. So hopefully you might spread word about those two films. In addition, I think people need to learn more, teach people more, and then get connected with us. Like us on Facebook. We have a Global Network Facebook page. We have a Facebook page called Keep Space for Peace Week. So people could like those. And we're constantly posting articles from all over the world about all of these issues. So that's bottom line. And get in touch with me directly, and we can take it from there if people really want to get actively involved.
Here is a segment from the intro to A.M. Gitlitz's book, I Want to Believe. Raised in the era when the Bolshevik Revolution echoed throughout the world, Posadas discovered Trotskyism as an alternative to the counter-revolutionary positions of both social democracy and Stalinism. An adept union organizer and propaganda pusher, he climbed the ranks of the Fourth International to become secretary of the Latin American Bureau. Emboldened by the Cuban Revolution in 1959, he split his sections into his own international based on the Latin American workers' movement and emerging guerrilla struggles. This was the peak of Posadas's influence, and it overlapped with the most ardent period of the space race, when the few Soviet cosmists to have survived the gulags propelled humanity to new heights with the launch of Sputnik. In no other era were the destructive and creative urges of humanity so obviously aligned as when intercontinental ballistic missiles designed to destroy distant cities were instead pointed upwards to take humanity to new heights, and one could credibly read Golden Age science fiction about utopian space colonies while huddled in a fallout shelter. As Posadas plotted his dramatic split in the fall of 1961, another small group dedicated to changing the world gathered for an informal conference in Greenbank, West Virginia. It was convened by Frank Drake, an astronomer and astrophysicist pioneer of the emerging science of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, also known as SETI. 11 scientists were chosen from the emerging field, among them 5 Nobel Prize winners, chemists, neuroscientists, and astronomers. He greeted them at the opening of the conference with an equation scrawled on the chalkboard, the Drake equation. N equals R asterisk FP NE FL FI FCL. N meant the number of civilizations in our galaxy with whom we could plausibly communicate. If their work was to have any meaning, the multiplication of a conservative estimate of each term would produce a value for N greater or equal to 1. The first 3 or 4 terms were matters of exobiology, a new field of speculative science studying the possibility of life forming on other planets based on what is known about how it formed on Earth. The average rate of star formation per year, R asterisk, the fraction of those stars with planets, FP, the average number of the planets that develop an ecosystem, NE, and the fraction of those planets that develop life, FL. With little debate, they determined, based on the vastness of the galaxy and the unlikeliness that Earth is wholly anomalous, that there were many inhabited planets. The next term, the fraction of that life that became intelligent, FI, was more philosophical. What does it mean to be intelligent? In his History of SETI, 5 billion Years of Solitude, Lee Billings described how neuroscientist John Lilly made a convincing argument that intelligence could be common on inhabited planets based on some of his unique research. He recounted his various attempts to communicate with the dolphins in their own language of clicks and whistles, and told stories of dolphins rescuing sailors lost at sea. He focused on one case in which two of his captive dolphins had acted together to rescue a third from drowning when it became fatigued in the cold water of a swimming pool. The chilled dolphin had let out two sharp whistles and an apparent call for help, spurring the two rescuers to chatter together, form a rescue plan, and save their distressed companion. The display convinced Lily that dolphins were a second terrestrial intelligence, contemporaneous with humans, capable of complex communication, future planning, empathy, and self-reflection. Alongside the theory of convergent evolution, that similarities in environmental conditions led isolated populations to evolve in similar ways, the conference optimistically placed the chance of intelligence arising on 1% of the planets with life. The next two terms were more apt for science fiction, anthropology, and political theory. The fraction of that intelligent life that develops the ability for interstellar communication, FC, and the average length that those civilizations persist with that ability, or their longevity, L. The conference debated the emergence of empires and colonialism and asked whether it would necessarily be preferable for intelligent beings to civilize, develop technology, and explore their surroundings. Ultimately, they decided a significant percentage of intelligent life would share our desire to discover our place in the cosmos. The only question left was how long a communicative alien civilization would survive. Philip Morrison, a veteran of the Manhattan Project who personally assembled the atomic bomb that destroyed Nagasaki, made a bleak argument. If human civilization was optimistically used as the measure for the previous term, it should be pessimistically applied to this one. It was the youngest attendee of the conference, a shaggy-haired 27-year-old astronomer named Carl Sagan, who offered the most vocal defense of longevity. He reminded Morrison that they had already agreed on a vast quantity of alien civilizations, and out of that mass there would be a variety of results. Some civilizations could be like ours, perhaps destroying themselves the moment they discovered interstellar communication, but others would surpass or even avoid that moment altogether, moving on to a higher stage of wisdom and sustainability in which they could discover the secret to interstellar travel and immortality. It was a potentiality, he reminded the conference, that still existed for us. Drake split the difference between Morrison and Sagan, setting the final term at 10,000 years. That gave them a result of about 10,000 contemporaneous communicable civilizations in our galaxy, and the conference ended with a toast to longevity, ours and theirs. The result may have satisfied most of the attendees, but Sagan believed the findings for N were far too low. He started a collaboration with Soviet astronomer Iosif Slavsky to develop a fully scientific argument for his conception of extraterrestrial civilizations. In 1965, they published Intelligent Life in the Universe, which asserted that there are between 50,000 and 1 million advanced civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy, and that we ought to attempt to contact them. Quote, "It is of no use to maintain an interstellar radio silence. The signal has already been sent. 40 light-years out from Earth, the news of a new technical civilization is winging its way among the stars. If there are beings out there, scanning their skies for the tidings of a new technical civilization, they will know of it, whether for good or for ill. If interstellar spaceflight by advanced technical civilizations is commonplace, we may expect an emissary, perhaps in the next several hundred years. Hopefully, there will then still be a thriving terrestrial civilization to greet the visitors from the far, distant stars." End quote. Sklovsky closed the Russian edition of the book by making clear his belief that it would take the eradication of capitalism and the construction of communism to make human civilization sustainable. Sagan didn't exactly disagree, saying he hoped new systems could emerge more advanced than Karl Marx's still unfulfilled vision. He continued this coy distance to politics for the rest of his career, refusing to confirm or deny his belief in socialism as he steered SETI towards the explicitly political and implicitly anti-capitalist goal of organizing human life towards betterment and sustainability. An anti-war, anti-nuclear, and environmental activist, his love for the planet and humanity was best represented in the gold vinyl records that he and his wife, Anne Druin, also ambiguously Marxist, loaded onto the Voyager spacecraft as a warm invitation bound for distant stars. The messages were vaingloriously utopian, Billings wrote, excluding references to such entropic human failings as crime, war, famine, disease, and death. Messages of greetings for terrestrial leaders in 54 languages, combined with hundreds of idyllic images of our planet, songs from around our world, and a roadmap for how to find us. In the 80s, they televised their xenophilic conception of SETI to the masses with Cosmos, a show that made Sagan one of the most influential and beloved scientists in the world. By the time he passed away in 1996, their work made belief in extraterrestrial life and the value in attempting contact stronger among the public than ever. But this came at a time when federal funding for SETI was being slashed, alongside all public scientific and social spending, to nearly nothing. That research is today left to the mercy of private donors, unlikely to see any return from a search that could take millennia. It was a testament to how even science, liberalism, secular religion, could be stymied by that enemy of longevity which, he and Morrison both agreed, could not continue forever. Capitalism. Today, one can imagine Sagan's Immortals or a socialist Martian from Red Star looking down at Earth and wondering why we are still so backwards, belligerent, and self-destructive. The idea that we are being visited, abducted, or simply monitored by a vastly superior intelligence creates a sense of what the political theorist Jody Dean called the extraterrestrial gaze, a perspective that undergirds capitalist realism, the idea that liberal democratic capitalism represents the end of history and nothing better can possibly exist. But just because it's hard for today's younger generations to understand why millions believed in communism during the 50s and 60s doesn't mean they don't want a better world. Now that it's just as realistic to fantasize about a queer commune on Mars as drinkable water in Flint, jokes about fully automated luxury gay space communism communicate that if nothing is possible, then at least we can demand what we really want, since it remains equally unattainable as our more pragmatic concerns. Revolutionaries have always pushed the argument that our true desires can only be achieved through the overthrow of the current social order, and Posadas injected a certain space-age catastrophism to this logic. He did so with an amateurish flair for speculation, and given what we know about nuclear winter, he was completely wrong. But then again, so was everyone else. Of Posadas' extensive catalog of unfulfilled prophecies, one summed up this tragic aspect of the Posadist comedy. "The joke will disappear," he wrote in 1976. Quote, "In 20 or 30 years, jokes will be old-fashioned. They are the result of these relations of private property to conquer difficulties, to struggle, to dispute. In socialism, there will be no necessity for humor," end quote. It turned out to be a type of internet joke, the meme, that served as the genesis device of neo-Posadism. Images shared on social media portrayed the elderly Argentine in his gray jumpsuit and shock of white hair imposed on a background of mushroom clouds, leaping dolphins, and whizzing flying saucers. The fact that humorous portrayals of eccentric aspects were foundational to his reemergence raises the question, is it better to be cartoonishly remembered or accurately forgotten? It was not just his bizarre beliefs that continue to make Posadas a joke, but that he believed anything at all. While the Posadists may be popularly remembered as brainwashed Bolsheviks or socialist Scientologists, their commitment to class struggle was very real. They fought in the Sierras of Cuba and Guatemala with Castro and Yon Soso, organized factories in Argentina, Uruguay, Britain, and France, fought on the front lines of student movements in Mexico, and organized a mass movement of peasants in Brazil. They spent combined decades in prison. Some disappeared in the torture chambers or thrown from the helicopters of the Condor dictatorships. Were they all fools of a charismatic charlatan? Or was there a path to socialism that, through some errant coin toss of history, now seems permanently blocked? In Sagan's and Druyan's final book, The Demon-Haunted World, they revealed a strange hobby of smuggling Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution to their counterparts in the Soviet Union so they could, quote, know a little about their own political beginnings, end quote. Likening Stalin's prosecution of Trotsky to American xenophobia or Dark Age witch trials, he hoped the encounter with their unknown origins could help guide them to a better future. it's hard to keep potent historical truths bottled up forever. New data repositories are uncovered. New, less ideological generations of historians grew up, Sagan wrote. Messages of a dead and defeated past, whether they be failed revolutionaries or long-dead civilizations, still have much to tell us about our future. The nihilistic posture of today's youth, on the other hand, combines a recognition of the failures of the past century with an inability to imagine beginning anew. The possibility of revolution confronts them, in a sense, like a paranormal phenomena. Though such a possibility may be described as a psychopathic delusion or demonic invocation by reactionaries, for those who have experienced it in moments of collective struggle, felt it like a premonition, or just read about it in books, it is an invitation to a reality radically freed from its preconceived limitations. Insurrection or first contact could come any day. Marxists and ufologists both tell us, but both are far more likely if we desire them. Embracing a sentiment enigmatically expressed in a meme come before its time. A poster on the wall of rogue FBI agent Fox Mulder in the 1990s sci-fi noir, The X-Files. Hovering alongside a grainy image of a comically unconvincing flying saucer, the words, "I want to believe."